Marvin Wilson is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead by the end of the show. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world. Where final preparations are underway to execute Wilson by injecting him with an overdose of a drug made to save lives. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Professor Jody Madeira, author of Killing McVeigh, a groundbreaking book examining the concept of closure. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and I am Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch on radio station KPFT. Might be a good time to remind you that KPFT will begin fundraising next week, and if it is possible for you to support this program, you can go to kpft.org, and we call it the tip jar, which seems kind of bizarre to be giving people tips while they're talking about an execution, but somehow or other I didn't set the system up, and that's how it works. I've got a studio full of the usual suspects in here tonight. That wonderful voice that you've already heard on the billboard was Larry Douglas, and he's going to be explaining some of the legal ramifications. Susan Ashley will tell you what actually happened in this case, and then Jim Skelton will try to wade through some of the specific legal issues in this last round of appeals. I take it that Gloria is on hold. We will go to that call now. Do you want to manage the buttons?
Our sympathy,
Gloria.
Our sorrow.
Gloria?
May you be blessed with the strength to be with your loved one tonight and carry his memory with you forever.
Gloria is speaking to the crowd outside. She is not only our reporter, but she is also the lady with the bullhorn. Gloria, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's
Marvin
wonderful.
Wilson's family.
I caught you working, and that's what it's all about. What is happening?
Marvin Wilson's son. Oh, God. His three sisters and a friend are now walking into the death house to witness an execution that should not be happening. I was just speaking with the nephew, Marvin Wilson's son's cousin, who's standing out here, who can barely speak. And he said he was here with Wilson's son to be with him and to go pick up his dad's property after the execution, and asked me for my sign that had a nice big color picture of Mr. Wilson on it, and said he wanted to keep it forever. So there's a large crowd. I'm on KPFT. There's a large crowd of people out there. There must be 10, 20, close to 30 people out here. People from Austin, Houston, Huntsville. There are some foreign visitors. I can't remember where they're from. There's members of the Texas After Violence Project, including its new director, who are here. And a number of news media outlets, including Dutch Public Television.
Yeah, Dutch Public Television was in the studio for the prison show Friday. Gloria, have they changed the process up? Does the media go in separately before you get there?
No. Thank you. The media goes in right before the family.
Okay. So the
people that go in separately, if they're here, and I understand they are, is the families of the victim. They're allowed to have five people go in also. But they are taken in the back door somewhere before any of this happens, so that there's never any contact with the victim's family and the prisoner's family. Of course, in a few minutes, Marvin Lee Wilson's family will be a victim's family.
Okay. Gloria, keep us informed. I don't know how long the process. The last time it took a little longer. And yeah. I'm concerned about those related issues, and we're going to be discussing them on the show here. So keep us informed of what happens. If there's anything going on we need to know about, call us back.
Okay, and I just want to say my condolences to Marvin's friends on the row.
Sure, and they're listening tonight, as usual. Thank you. Gloria Ruback with the abolition movement. She is in Huntsville at the vigil that is going on place. 30 people, that's a crowd that's a little larger than others. And what's happening now is the producer is trying to get, there is a Houston vigil involving Dave Atwood. And I believe they're over at St. Stephen's Church, but we will find out whenever we get them on the telephone and all of that. Marvin Wilson was convicted way back in 1992. Was that when he was convicted?
Yes.
In 1992, this incident happened in November of 1992. Is that Dave? Put him on. Dave, this is Ray. You're on the air.
Okay, Ray. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you. Where are you?
We're out in front of St. Stephen's Church on West Alabama. We've got a pretty decent group out here today, about 10 or 12 people. And so we're this is one of the four places in Houston that we rotate. And so we're at St. Stephen's right now.
You're in St. Stephen's. You go to St. Anne's. You go over there in Alameda where the convent is. There are several locations to use.
And then in front of St. Paul's down there by the museums.
St. Paul's, the big Methodist church there.
Right. And really what we do, we stand out on the street. We're not, you know, it's not really associated with the church so much, other than symbolic perhaps to a certain extent, but we're out on the street where all the traffic is going by, and this is a very, very busy corner, especially at rush hour. A lot of traffic going back and forth. So we're out here with all our signs and our banners, and I think it's an effective way of getting the word out that there's a, you know, fair number of people who oppose what's going on with the death penalty. And of course today, with this particular case of a intellectually disabled man, it's just horrific that this is going forward. I can't believe that they're doing it.
Well, the witnesses and the media have crossed the road, so the process is ongoing.
We
will keep you posted in that regards. Dave Atwood is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And what is that email? That not that email, but the website.
It's tcadp.org.
TCADP.org. TCADP.org. That is the acronym, and you can reach Dave and his supporters over there. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, Ray.
We'll,
you take care.
We'll keep you informed. Bye-bye.
All righty. Thank you.
And that's the two reports from the scene. We have demonstrations going on outside the death house in Huntsville and over not far from the station on West Alabama at Woodhead, where the St. Stephen's Episcopal Church is, with the support of the rector and the congregation there. The group in the studio are, of course, Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and myself. We're going to go to the interview first, a change in format here. Any opening comments that bother you about this case?
Yeah, a whole bunch bothers me about this case, but it's kind of hard to talk about it right now.
Okay. Getting cut off. Get into a longer interview.
Sure.
Susan, any comment going in?
Not now.
Okay.
Nothing now for me, Ray.
Okay, now everybody. Now, what can I explain to them what happens before we do this? Jim and Larry and Susan are in touch with one another, and Jim works up with their help all of the details of this case. And this is a little more elaborate case than most cases. Number one, it's been around for a long time. They had, in this case, two separate trials. And I'm not talking about redoing the sentencing hearing. They did a whole nother separate trial. After the first one, something went wrong with that, and you'll learn about that as the program goes on. So there has been a great deal of legal energy and effort put into this case. And this case is from Jefferson County, Texas. which is Beaumont, or part of Beaumont. Beaumont is bigger than Jefferson County, which is kind of surprising. We think of Harris County as being bigger than Houston, but over there, Beaumont is bigger than Jefferson County. So the taxpayers in that county have supported a good bit of this case, and we're going to be talking that as it goes on. I am awaiting a telephone connection to the interview whenever Elizabeth gets ready for that, and we will go that on. But right now, I want you to keep in mind that a human being, one which there has been serious discussion about his mental culpability under existing court rules. The Supreme Court of the United States said that retarded people suffering mental retardation should not be subject to the death penalty. However, the Supreme Court of the United States did not define that adequately.
Let me tell you something that's, to me, more troubling than even that. And this case is a real good example of it. First off, the Supreme Court never told us when we can bring mental retardation up. That was the first thing. And my problem has always been that if a jury hears all the brutal facts about a case, even if there is proof that he's mentally retarded, they're going to vote for the death penalty because they're scared to death he'll do it again, because you can't cure somebody mentally retarded. This case is especially interesting because the person killed was a police informant. And policemen do not like their informants being killed, and it's equivalent to killing a first cousin of a policeman. And the most critical part of any death penalty case other than the trial is going to be the post-conviction state writ. Well, the judge who heard the writ is Larry Guess. Larry Guess is a former prosecutor. So he's hearing a case in his jurisdiction where policemen are going to vote. He's a former prosecutor. Policemen are going to be present during the trial because you know as well as I do.
Yeah. I've seen that show.
You've seen that show before.
I've seen that show before.
And so as you know as well as I do, it's going to be a lot of pressure on him to have findings of facts, conclusions of law favorable to his electorate. His electorate in that case is going to be the police. And I was discussing this with Susan and Larry before the show began. And it seems to me if we're going to be fair about this, that when you have post-conviction writs, the writ should not be filed and heard by the same judge who heard the case itself. Because traditionally the way it works, when a judge presides over a capital case, he is also the judge that presides over the writ hearing. And most judges have kind of a secret, not an interest, they have a strong inclination when they say they did right. And when you start attacking what happened at the trial level, at the writ level, they're going to have a conflict of interest because basically it's attacking the fairness of the trial that they themselves presided over. So I think if we're really going to be fair about most of these writ hearings, that we should not permit a judge who heard the facts of the case be the same judge that hears the writ. Because that would eliminate that conflict that judges are going to have to want to see that. Because everyone wants to admit that they presided over a trial that was unfair. No one's going to want to say
no, no one wants to get reversed.
And you take this case. Here we've got Larry Guest, a former prosecutor who's now who was on the bench, and he's having a case in which if he rules favorably for the defense, a police informant gets killed. And you think that's going to be not going to be pressure on him to find findings of facts, conclusion of law favorable to the state. And that really is not a fair forum. That's like having a trial when you're accused of beating up your wife and you're having the trial at your wife's family reunion. That's basically what it amounts to. And I think under the writ procedure, if you really want to be fair, the writ judge should not be the judge who presided over the trial. And in cases like this, it should not even be in the same jurisdiction where the police informant was killed.
Are such exceptions made?
No. Well, the one thing about it, one of the reasons there's been no exceptions made, because this issue's never been brought up before. Because this has never been brought up in any writ proceedings about the unfairness of trying a writ in front of a judge who heard the case, nor has it been brought up in this particular case, the unfairness of having a police informant who's the victim of a murder being tried in a court where policemen are present and being tried by a former prosecutor who's now a judge. Now Larry Guest has got a reputation. I tried a case against him years ago. And Larry Guest has a reputation for being a decent, fair-minded man, but he's also a politician.
Well, he's got to be. He gets elected.
I mean, that's, he gets elected. And it is foolish to think that he wouldn't. I mean, that's just only human nature. If your job's at jeopardy, if you
will. Yeah, you know, that's what you bring up is not an unusual thing. I remember way back in the Clarence Brantley thing. We started out with prosecutor and the judge conspiring to destroy some evidence.
Plus the district clerk. Don't forget the district clerk.
Yeah, she was in the room. She's where we got the information about it.
Yeah.
And so destroying evidence in a case. And then as thing progressed, the district attorney became the judge in that court.
Jim Keeshan.
Yeah.
His Keeshan was the district attorney.
And so that Clarence's problem is that he was not guilty of the crime, but he could not get a fair hearing in a court and prosecutor trying to protect their apparently tender careers.
This case, when you said there's something about this case that bothers me, that bothers me. Because it's not even a close to being a fair level field. It's just not. And I just think, again, going back to what I say, we got to understand that these are human beings that make decisions. And in a death penalty case, other than the trial, the single most critical hearing is the writ procedure after the direct appeal is over with.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the rubber hits the road. And if you want to really have a fair way of handling a case, then you should have fair and impartial people who will not be persuaded by politics.
Well, what we did in the Brantley case is Sam Houston Clinton and Charlie Bayard of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals appointed a judge from Amarillo, Texas, to come down here and give a look at the case, and that pulled the lid off the bottle. I am told that our interview guest is now online. Would you put Professor Jody Madeira on this? Hello, Professor. Professor, can you hear me? Professor, can you hear me? Hello? Professor? Can you hear me? Would somebody work on that technical problem?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Thank you very much. I appreciate a response because I was beginning to panic.
Yes.
Professor Jody Madeira wrote the book, Killing McVeigh, The Death Penalty and the Myth of Closure. Number one, my immediate impression upon beginning the book was your motivation for picking this particular case. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, actually, although it was a very different context, my father died in a very, every car accident that results in a fatality is tragic, but my father died in a case where he was crushed in between two tractor trailers, and the police investigating the incident, you know, did no blood alcohol content, testing of the driver, did not check his log. And it was almost like a criminal negligence. And so we instituted a 10-year-long wrongful death lawsuit against the truck driver in German court and basically found it to be a very disheartening event that basically tied us to this death for long after we should have moved on. And so the question that I wanted to investigate coming out of this was, you know, what impact do legal proceedings have upon the lives of those such as murder victims, family members, accident family members, whose lives are basically, you know, thrust into legal proceedings.
And what is your actual field of study up at Indiana University?
I am actually a tenure-track professor in the law school. However, I am also a PhD in communication studies, and so I'm kind of an atypical law professor. I basically describe myself as a law and emotion researcher.
Well, that's Indiana might be a good place for that. Indiana's done some groundbreaking stuff on emotions some time ago. But the McVeigh case for the title of your book, you know, of all of the people that have been executed in America, I think if you did a loose poll of the general public, they would be more accepting of that execution than most others.
Certainly, I think you're right.
And so that adds a little more emphasis. Now, the question of closure, did you ever or do you ever anticipate getting closure in your father's homicide?
I actually do not think we ever will. I mean, you get to the point where you move on, and actually, I think working through the question of what impact McVeigh's execution, trial and execution had upon victims' family members and survivors there, I think that also helped me to kind of come to grips with the fact that, you know, there are questions that will be unanswered. There are questions that even if I had answers, perhaps they wouldn't be satisfactory. And I think you really have to kind of move on. One of my participants that I interviewed put it very eloquently when basically she said, this is a chapter in the book of my life, and I can close it at this point, and I can put it back on the shelf, but I can still take it down. And sometimes, you know, people take it down and thrust it into my hands, like on the anniversary of the bombing. But this is really something that you don't want to forget.
And you were able to interview, apparently, a good many of the survivors of that tragedy.
Yes, 33 victims, family members, and survivors, including 10 execution witnesses.
And what did they tell you was the impact on them on witnessing the execution?
Well, it differed from person to person. Usually, the reaction to witnessing the execution was that it was very quick and that it was much more peaceful than they expected and perhaps than they would have wished. And there are many other people who, you know, did not want to witness the execution, even if they were pro-death penalty, because they knew that they felt, you know, they would really not get that much out of it. It was just the knowledge that it had taken place that was satisfactory. But I think, you know, everyone was expecting something different. But I think at the end, you know, what they got, most people after the execution felt a sense of relief. And I think that was because not so much that McVeigh was dead, but just that because he was silenced, because he was such a visible defendant prior to his execution.
The mixed bag of results, in your subjective opinion, did the execution itself bring any comfort to anybody's life?
I do think it brought comfort, but I think it's difficult to tease apart the comfort that the execution itself brought from the comfort that knowing McVeigh was silenced brought. And I think the two, for most people, are tied together. It would have been a different question entirely if McVeigh was a much quieter person. You know, Stephen Jones pursued a very visible defense for his client on the trial level. Nichols' attorney, Michael Tiger, chose a different strategy of basically keeping his client out of the media, and McVeigh himself sought out media attention. And so if we hadn't executed McVeigh, I believe if he would have just been left alone in prison and the media had ceased to pay attention to him, I believe that the same results would have obtained.
Of course, you understand that's a very difficult thing to ask the media to do.
Oh, absolutely.
And the media's a hunger for sensationalism. Matter of fact, I worry about Execution Watch as a phenomenon, and wonder if we're not piggybacking on someone else's bad experience. But I would feel worse if we were executing people in Texas and nobody was paying attention to it.
Exactly. And I think that you have to draw a line between what is newsworthy and almost destroying the newsworthiness of the topics you cover and how you cover them. So, for example, take James E. Holmes, the Aurora shooter. You know, we're plastering his picture above the fold in the newspapers every chance we can get. And that is not necessary in my view. What is necessary is that we investigate and report on his motivations, on his history, but we don't have to necessarily tie his photograph with that information. And I think what really matters isn't just the visibility. It's literally the visibility of the offender in the news, not necessarily news about the offender, if that makes sense.
As a person who's trained in legal stuff, you understand that all that publicity creates problems for not only the defense lawyer, but the prosecution as well.
Oh, yes, because of the change of venues. And, in fact, you know, we ran into that problem in the McVeigh case. And it also is worse for the victims' families because all of a sudden, you know, the trial is moved out of their communities, and so it becomes a hardship for them to attend.
How important is it for families to attend those trials?
I think it depends on the family members. I think it's very important because it's very important for several reasons. They get information from the trials that they can't get anywhere else. It also provides them with an opportunity to basically look at the person that allegedly committed this murder. And that confrontation or that observation can be very important. But yet trials also aren't ideal venues for answering all questions. The question family members most want answered, why this occurred, isn't really the focus of the legal proceeding. For example, McVeigh's motive allegedly for the bombing was to protest against Waco and Ruby Ridge. And that wasn't satisfactory for victims' families and survivors. You know, why did they choose that bombing, that building? Why did he have to blow it up when people were in it? And those questions like that are not the focus properly of legal proceedings.
Is there something different about those of us who have had homicides happen close? I've lost two former companions to homicide. Mm. You lost your father to homicide. Are we somehow different from other people?
I think that the answer to that is yes. And even I would not necessarily group myself together with murder victims' family members because of the circumstances of my father's death. You know, I think negligent homicide is different than criminal homicide. Mm-hmm. in the intent question. And so I have not walked in the shoes that you have, for example. But at the same time, I can begin to see, you know, questions that emerge. And I think that murder victims' family members, when they meet other family members or when survivors of 9/11 meet other survivors, such as those from Oklahoma City, they find that unlike anyone else around them who hasn't gone through these episodes, that these people they're the ones who speak a common language, and they can understand sometimes without even, you know, going into great detail what they have gone through and what they will go through in the future.
My experience is bifurcated in so many ways, but Dale was killed by a burglar, a minority person in his apartment. He came home and interrupted a burglary in process and got killed.
Mm.
That person was tried, convicted, and executed, and Dale's sister and I joined the vigil opposed to the execution outside the death house. We felt obligated to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The other one of my companion was assassinated by a police officer. It took me over a year and a half to get him indicted and another year before he went to trial, and he was, of course, acquitted.
Mm.
And I actually don't have any more closure over the execution of Dale's assailant than I have over the exoneration of Fred's assassin.
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on, you know, the particular circumstances of each case. An execution is not by itself going to give closure. And often I think it works against closure because it ties people to the case for years and years and years. You know, another trial and potential execution that we could have seen occurred in the case of Matthew Shepard. The gay teenager who unfortunately was beaten savagely and tied to a fence in Laramie, Wyoming.
Yeah, I know Judy, and yes. Have written extensively about the Shepherd case.
And that case, you know, the parents actually said, we don't want the death penalty because we don't want to tie ourselves to the offenders. We want to be
Well, I think one of the things, Matthew was of that opinion, and his parents adopted his opinion after he was dead.
Yes. And I think that was very moving. And they weren't showing the offender mercy so much as they were giving mercy to themselves, permission to move on.
Yeah, do you get the impression that the closer issue and the machinations of the law are just totally unrelated?
I think so. I think the law has adopted a closure rhetoric, unfortunately. And it helps to make the death penalty more salient in an era where it's so hard to defend economically, morally, even politically. And but yet the law has embraced victims' family members. For example, you know, in Payne v. In Payne, the Supreme Court did a 180 and said that all of a sudden the states could give could allow victims' families to give victim impact testimony. And I think that embrace of victims, starting with Payne, really has left a legacy and a stamp upon the judicial system. And we're in a state right now where victims' family members have a great deal at stake and perhaps not as much agency as they would like to have, but they certainly have a voice that they did not have before. And the law is just really unsure what to do with that.
We've been talking to Professor Jody Madeira, the author of Killing McVeigh, The Death Penalty and the Myth of Closure. And she's been rather forthcoming to us. How do people get in touch with you, Professor, and where do they find your book?
Well, they can find my book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and or they can just Google Killing McVeigh. And they can. I would welcome anybody to get in touch with me via email, which is available if you. My last name is just difficult to spell. It's it breaks the I before E rule. It's M A D E I R A. And
you know, I noticed that right off, Professor.
Yes.
But then, of course, I used to teach composition and rhetoric at Newcomb.
Right.
So.
I had my husband to thank. He was actually Portuguese.
Oh, okay.
So it's the same as Madeira wine, but
okay.
But yes, I welcome any contact, and you can get my contact information off my biography site at Indiana University Maurer School of Law.
Thank you very much for being on Execution Watch, and we really appreciate the thoroughness and depth of your work.
It was truly my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was, I think, a very interesting interview.
Let me mention something to you, Ray.
Let's get a microphone going here. Okay.
Let me mention something to you about closure. I'm talking to a lady this past week whose son was murdered or killed out in Arizona. Mm. And I spent a lot of time with the entire family. And I told her, and of course I've been through the court system, and I told her that one thing's going to happen. This word closure is a joke. It'll never change. And what I told her was basically this. Part of you died when your son died. Mm. And there's a hole in your life that'll never be the same. And what you're going to have hereafter is an altered life. Your life is going to be altered. And what you've got to learn to adjust to is adjust to the altered life. There's no such thing as closure. It'll always be there. But it's an altered lifestyle because you no longer have him to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be altered. And there's a marvelous article years ago written in New Yorker magazine called by Getting Over It, Getting Over It. And this talks about that, and the word closure never appeared in that article. I think closure is a joke. There's no such thing as closure. Because if you lose somebody that's close to you, your life is never going to be the same.
Well, I suspect all of us here with microphones in our faces have lost someone that was close to us. I mean, I had hundreds of friends die of HIV and AIDS during that.
Yeah, but they
pandemic.
Weren't killed.
They weren't killed. And those two
you
people.
You have time to get used to, you know, they're going to get sick. You know it's going to come. But when someone's suddenly taken away, that's a whole different animal than you expect someone. Like,
yeah.
If they've been sick for a while, you can kind of prepare for it.
You can adjust when they get sick. That was Richard Skelton, excuse me, Jim Skelton and I having a sidebar conversation about closure. And so I think we need to know what happened in this case. We are waiting word from Huntsville. Gloria will call and say the witnesses have crossed the road back, and that's the end of the process. And I can see our producer is on the telephone right now, so I don't know if that's for us, but we're going to go on with Ashley. Susan telling us about what happened in this case.
What happens in this case is Marvin Wilson is convicted of killing Jerry Williams. Jerry Williams is an undercover informant or snitch who obtained information for police that allowed police to get a search warrant and essentially to get to bust Marvin Wilson.
Susan, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We have a report from Huntsville. Hello, Gloria. You're on the air. Gloria.
But it's so important for people to hear that this monster that they killed had real family and friends that loved them.
Gloria's carrying on a conversation with folks around her, which is a good thing, that we're getting Gloria on her workaday. Gloria.
Yes. Hi, Ray.
You're on the air.
Okay. Well, the execution has happened. It's a very sad, another sad day in this damn city. But I'm standing next to a woman that's been a pen pal of Marvin Wilson's for years. And I was just talking to the mother of his son, and she told me that this pen friend was standing here. So I asked her if she'd speak with you, and she said she would.
Okay. Put her on.
Okay.
This is Ray.
Hello?
Hi, Ray.
What
Hi.
Is your name?
My name is Drew Kutka. My full name is Drusilla. I go by Drew.
Drew, and where are you? Where from whence did the hail?
I live in McKinney, Texas. It's north of Dallas.
Uh-huh.
I'm involved in a prison ministry at my church, St.
Okay.
Gabriel.
Is the outreach especially to death row?
It is to death row, but it's to all imprisoned.
Well, I am sorry for the loss of your friend today.
Thank you so much.
I think we're all on the same side of that issue. What yes. we do on the prison show is we try to explain what happened in the case, what happened in the courts, what happened in the appeals that got us to this point. And is there something you want our audience to know from your special relationship with Marvin?
Well, I think what I would want them to know is that Marvin was a human being. He was a man of God. He was an awesome man of God. He was a blessing in my life. He was a blessing to the people, his other inmates at Polanski. He ministered to them. Marvin always told me, he said that he used to be a bad guy. He was a drug dealer, street crime, but he said he did not commit capital murder. I know you're probably, a lot of people are thinking, oh, that's what they all say, but there are a lot of innocent men that are executed, and it's just, it's wrong to kill. It's not us, our judgment, it's God. I just, you know, Marvin had a son, an ex-wife. He was a friend, a brother in Christ to me. He was a good man, and you know, I can't say that for a lot of people out here in the free world. You know, I just think it's wrong to execute. It needs to be changed. The law needs to be changed. The death penalty is not working.
Well, the important thing is for you to tell your friends that are living, because this everything ultimately is a political issue.
Right. Right.
Thank you very much for being on the prison show. Bye-bye.
Oh, you're so very welcome. God bless you. Thank you.
Elizabeth, would you call and tell David that the process is complete so that that has some closure? And I'm sorry to have interrupted your fine report, so continue, please.
Well, what happens is police use a 21-year-old man named Jerry Williams to obtain information on Marvin Wilson. Okay, this information allows police to get a search warrant. Police get a search warrant, and they basically come in and they bust Marvin Wilson and another man named Vincent Webb, they're both at the apartment. Right before the police came in and arrested them for the cocaine, Jerry Williams had been at the apartment and had left, and then police came in minutes later. So what happens is, Wilson goes to jail and Vincent Webb goes to jail. After Wilson bails out of jail, of course, he knows that basically he was arrested because of a snitch, and he tells a woman named Terry Lewis that he's going to get the snitch, meaning that he's going to kill him.
This is Wilson. This is not Marvin.
Marvin Wilson.
Okay.
It's the same person, Marvin Wilson. Okay, so a few days later, on November 9th, Marvin Wilson is at the parking lot of a grocery store, Mike's Grocery, which apparently is a convenience store that has gas pumps. He sees the man he recognizes and he knows as Jerry Williams, who's the snitch. He sees them. He comes over and he starts beating them up. Williams struggles to get away. Williams begs for his life. Williams says, you know, that you're a snitch. Do you know what happens to snitch? And Williams, you know, begs for his life. A friend of his name, a friend of Wilson's named Andrew Lewis, also happens to be at the same parking lot pumping gas in his car. When Williams runs away, Wilson runs, goes after him, and Andrew Lewis follows in the car. So when Williams goes, runs into a field, Andrew Lewis drives the car to the field, and both men abduct Williams, put him in the car. They take him to a location that is apparently close to a mobile plant. And then what happens is essentially the Wilson shoots Williams, and they leave the body there. And then the next day, a bus driver sees the body in the street. Now, after that, Wilson tells the wife, he tells his wife that basically that he got the snitch, the man that snitched on him. And then he also present at the same time is Andrew Lewis's wife. And Andrew Lewis's wife, what Wilson ends up saying to Andrew Lewis's wife is, don't be mad at your husband. I'm the one that did it. And that was basically it.
And Susan, you also forgot the fact outside that grocery store there were three or four witnesses,
right,
one of whom had known the defendant for a long time, identified him, the rest of them identified him. So it was the abduction and the beating occurred in the presence of about three people, all of whom identified.
Right.
But present at the killing was Lewis and Wilson.
Yes. But there were four people at the parking lot. Two of them knew them. And then the other two didn't know them, but they recognized them from photo.
Now, added to that, it wasn't in the opinion itself, but during the writ reading, I found out that part of the theory is going to be, if the case is retried, is that during some of the writ proceedings, they found a forensic expert who testified that the decedent was not killed until the next morning.
Mm.
And they also found a Caucasian hair in his hand, which implies the killer might have been a Caucasian person. He was killed the next morning. They claimed they were going to develop that later if they got a new trial. So there was some dispute, at least during the writ proceedings, that perhaps...
Is that usual for them to have a fallback theory if they got a new trial?
They'll oftentimes do that to kind of get the court to give them a writ granting, because a lot of times these writs are just kind of a waste of time. You retry it, they're going to get convicted again. But in this particular case, they brought up in the writ proceedings that they did have a forensic expert. He would cast a great deal of doubt on whether or not Wilson was in fact the shooter, because they claimed the shooting did not occur until the morning, not that night, when the people heard the shot.
Well, this case was like tried twice.
Yes, it was tried twice, but this never came up in either of the other two trials. This is something that came up during the writ proceedings.
Well, two of the witnesses, Zeno and Ware, who had been at the parking lot, they went back to their apartments, and they said that they heard gunshots
coming from
the mobile, the location of where the mobile refinery was.
Right, but they didn't see it. They just heard the shots.
They just heard gunshots.
Larry, you're going to tell us what happened in the trials?
In the punishment phase, yeah. The facts were pretty horrendous, including Wilson telling Williams, what do you want to be a snitch for, reportedly? Do you know what we do to snitches? Do you want to die right here? So the facts are horrendous, and then it's a matter of he's found guilty of capital murder, which means there's a decision to make by the jury. Do we give him life in prison, or do we kill him?
Mm-hmm.
So what the prosecutor's job then to do is to provide evidence giving the jury reason to kill Marvin Wilson. And the evidence they provide is that Marvin Wilson has been convicted of aggravated robbery, but two aggravated robberies and one robbery. He was convicted of two aggravated robberies in 1981. In one of those robberies, he actually pointed a shotgun at a convenience store clerk, and then a robbery in 1987. And then the other thing they do is they line up officers. If he's got a criminal record, they line up officers to come forward and testify about his reputation of being a peaceable and law-abiding citizen. And, you know, they say that reputation was bad. So all of that's used to, after he's convicted, to convince the jury to impose a death sentence.
The police informant angle, is that important in this case?
Well, I think so, clearly, particularly for the police officers and for the plea for law enforcement kind of thing, issue in terms of punishment, because if he... The facts of the case seemed to suggest that he was making an example of an informant. So I would imagine that certainly would be used against him in terms of the safety of informants, because, you know, police officers really don't take too kindly to people who go out and kill the informant, particularly because they depend so heavily on confidential informants. I guess the issue of confidentiality.
Well, they weren't very good about the confidentiality in this case.
Let me explain, Ray. One thing you can read between the lines in this case, here's how these informant deals usually work. They have information a guy's got a crack house.
Yeah.
But they can't catch anybody. So what they do, they get an informant to go in and what we call a buy bust.
Sure.
They go in and make a buy. And then when they buy, what they'll do, they'll search the informant, send him in the house, and he'll make a buy. This happens all the time. Then the informant comes out and gives the drugs to the police. They then get a search warrant, and then they go in the house and make a bust. And between the lines, this is exactly what happened in this case. This was a buy bust. It's a real common police practice.
Mode of operation.
Absolutely. And so what you're doing, if you don't protect guys like this, it's going to be difficult to get for a lot of informants to want to do a buy bust if they get killed afterwards.
Jim, if somebody broke in the front door and came in here and beat you and I up, they would have a special range of punishment because that is assault on a senior citizen.
The old Codger's
protection law.
They'd have to go through me.
I understand.
Okay.
That
well, over here
but you're looking for another client in your criminal practice.
They'd
don't
have to go
on.
Through
you
right
don't,
me.
You're not fooling me, girlfriend. But
like the Afghan hound.
Now, and then there's a special classification to punishment people that kill police officers. And so if you kill a snitch...
No special classification,
but they tried to extend that cop one down to include
you. Well, you're going to find when you go to a trial like this that the police are going to support. They're going to be there in big support.
Yeah.
Because, again, being a snitch is kind of a short lifespan. They don't get good insurance policies, I'm telling
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. If you do the actuary work on being a snitch,
yeah.
The guys at the row are enjoying this conversation, even though their friend just got killed. Because they're listening in on this, and I'm serious as a heart attack. It seems as if the people go out of the way. Would this case be a capital case now?
I think Susan said, we talked about this earlier. I think
sure.
Susan said it right. Depends on who is the DA. This case. And I want Larry to discuss this. You talk about a guy that got a lot of due process. This guy, we got to be honest, the court system gave him a pretty good due process overall.
And he got two full rest trials.
Yeah. And Larry's going to run through all the different trials, things he got. But to answer your question, Ray, I would guess in a metropolitan area where you've got money enough to do it, if money wasn't a factor, I would say yes.
Okay.
For example, the case out in Arizona now, the guy that killed all the people in the federal judge, they're backing off from the death penalty. The primary reason, Pima County's broke.
Pima County got to go.
Right. And so I think if money was, interest were set aside, I think the police would put pressure on the DA's office to protect their snitches and seek the death penalty, be my guess. Go ahead, Larry.
I would point out that in most search warrants that are typically obtained from information from an undercover informant, people who are arrested typically know who the undercover informant is. In other words, they commonly, I would say most times, they know who snitched on them.
Oh, they can narrow it down pretty well. I mean, only so many people came
in. No matter what the circumstances.
I mean,
so
this is why they want protection for
us.
This is why I think the police have put a lot of pressure on the DAs to seek the death penalty protection.
Well,
this is a very typical mind bust.
We have a guy with marginal intelligence. I don't care where you put the line on retardation. This guy was marginally intelligent.
That's being generous, but go ahead.
Okay. Oh, do you think it's being?
Sure.
Okay. And
he couldn't pass a GED and TDC.
He couldn't pass a GED.
You know that.
Right. And he had been tested depending on, I understand he couldn't read.
At second grade level.
He could read at a second grade level. It's difficult to give an IQ test to an adult that read it at a second degree level. You've got to do that orally. And then that's a whole subjective. God, trust me, I've given IQ tests. That is a whole subjective process. It's not an objective process. And we spent more than $1 million.
No, easily.
Easily.
More than $1 million. What if instead of doing that, we had identified him in Jefferson County School District as a potential problem person and put a little money in helping him learn how to develop a coping, living way to deal with his mental restrictions without going to find a quick buck in the selling, using, trading crack business?
Here's the problem, Ray. What they did, they put him in vocational training.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't even do that well.
He
couldn't catch on to that. Because, see, the problem as I often said many times before, the only way you can cure somebody being retarded is to elect him a judge, and all of a sudden they become a genius. Short of him being elected judge, he ain't going to make it. And what they did in Beaumont, he basically flunked everything. And all of when he passed
school. Well, you certainly know how to pull out the lines to get the fellows down in the prison on your side.
I'm just telling you that's the truth. But this guy flunked everywhere. He was just what they call socially passed. They promoted him. And when they put him in a program for vocational training, and he even flunked out of that, couldn't do that. And he even, when he went to TDC, he couldn't even pass a GED test. Mm. He didn't have the gumption enough to even do that.
Well,
so I don't know why. The good question is, I don't know what you do with somebody like that.
There's probably as many extremely intelligent people that sell drugs as less intelligent people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of the drug stuff is folks feeling the pressure of crushing poverty or looking for an easy way out. That is not an intelligent factor issue.
No, I don't think it has anything
some
to do with
do
intelligence.
Some people do that with a lot more success than others,
right.
I'd also like to point out.
I mean, I would think if you're more intelligent, you may perhaps be a more profitable dealer than a less intelligent one, but I don't think intelligence has anything to do with it.
I think the most expensive way to dealing with this person is wait until they killed somebody and then spend all that money on capital series of trials that was going to go on and on forever, and the due process is not cheap.
Because, see, in a case like this, the truth of the matter is we probably, on people like this, the government should support them to some degree financially because they're not going to make it doing a living. And you can't expect somebody, I don't care how slow they are, when they watch television, see how well people live, and they have no money, they're going to make money.
Yeah.
And they tried educating this guy, tried doing vocational
training. Trust me, the same thing happens to me.
And I think that I would have no quarrel with having aid to people who are just incapable. Social Security will do some of that if you're physically disabled. And why shouldn't they do the same thing to people who are mentally disabled?
In light of this case, Larry, does Atkins have any meaning at all?
Yes. Okay, just a couple of things before I discuss the Atkins issue. And that is, one, we're using the term mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. We're not being insensitive or anything.
Right.
I noticed Dave Atwood used the term intellectually disabled.
Yeah, well,
that's the term we use in law.
Political.
And psychiatrists use it too.
And psychiatry uses the same term. And the other issue is, as Susan mentioned, they're intelligent people dealing drugs.
Sure.
They're retarded people dealing drugs. And retarded people, by and large, don't get involved in violent activity.
Yeah.
So there are lots of retarded people who could not
make very different choices,
read beyond the second grade level, who do much better at life, adaptive skills, and so forth than with Mr. Wilson. If the state's position regarding Atkins. Atkins is the case that provides that the state does not execute mentally retarded people. But there's got to be a showing of mental retardation, including the IQ test and the adaptive skills and onset by the age of, before the age of 18. If he were determined to be ineligible for the death penalty because of Atkins under this set of facts, I think that Atkins could then easily be used in a de facto a manner to abolish the death penalty. Because at that point, everybody who's on death row would just become retarded.
Okay.
But in his case, you know, we talked earlier about the fact that it took 20 years.
Well, this conversation is going to have to continue on our next round because it's time for me to turn the radio station over to the folks to do it. I want to remind people you're listening to radio station KPFT in Houston. What follows is Coming to America and Nuestra Palabra. This is Tuesday night, so kick back, get out your Spanish skills, and enjoy radio here on KPFT Houston. This is Ray Hill saying thank you for listening.